We're going to get started. Today is Friday, May 10th, 2013. We don't yet have a quorum. Members, we're going to get started on this bill. We're going to take public testimony today. Representative Liebling has an amendment that she's going to be offering to make it line up with the Senate. If we don't finish all of the questions and all of the testimony by 9:30, the majority of this committee has to be in rules. So we will recess and we'll come back after session because we're going to continue to hear this bill until everyone has asked every question they have and everyone that wants to testify has testified. And then it's my intention today to vote on this bill. Oh, we officially have a quorum, so I'll officially call the Judiciary, Finance, and Policy Committee to order. Representative Liebling, welcome to the committee. It's my understanding we are working off a new amendment. Representative Liebling, can you identify which one that is?
That's correct, Madam Chair. Good morning, members. It's the A6 amendment. And once we get that moved, Madam Chair, if you like, I can kind of explain what it is we're doing here.
Representative Liebling, go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And so, members, this bill has been moving through the Senate. It's passed the Senate Judiciary Committee, Finance Committee. And it's our attempt here is to match up with the Senate language, and we've all been working very closely together. And a lot of people are working on this extremely important bill. And so rather than walk in detail through the amendment, I just would like to highlight a couple of differences from what we were doing the last time we heard the bill in this committee. And as you'll recall, we did not take a vote on it. We had an amendment that came in late, and we just discussed it and then laid it over. So I appreciate the chair hearing the bill again today. And so if you'll notice, the A6 amendment does two major things. One is that it takes out Article 1, which I regret having to do, but we need to do this in order to move the bill along. And Article 1 is the article that had the working group on sexual violence, and it had some grants. And I would hope these are really important provisions, and they're very important to me, and I will hope to bring them back next session and move them separately. In fact, there was another bill this session that Representative Loeffler is carrying from MnCASA, Minnesota Coalition Against Sexual Assault, and these are the same pieces that were in there. So we're in no way getting rid of the idea of doing these pieces. In fact, in the HHS omnibus bill, there's some language requesting the commissioner to move forward with something very similar to this anyway. So but that's what we're doing here, is taking out that first article. The second important thing is that there is a panel of examiners who are intended to be independent examiners who would assist the court by reviewing the various patients on a regular basis. We had initially intended for those to be under the auspices of the court, but for various reasons, we weren't able to make that happen, so they're now under the auspices of the Department of Human Services. But it's intended that they would be quite independent. And the intention here is that those who are providing treatment would be independent from those who are doing the evaluations. This is very important because it would, we hope, improve the treatment that's going on in the facility, because it would mean that people who are doing treatment are going to get a look at their work on a regular basis. And without we as a legislature micromanaging treatment, which I don't think we're in a good position to do, this will be an independent check on that. So those are the main changes. So members, we can, obviously I have with me former Chief Justice Magnuson, and Commissioner Cindy Jessen from the Department of Human Services, and we can answer questions. But before we get to that, I really wanted to just sort of talk about where we're at with this bill generally. Because as everybody knows, this is a very volatile and difficult topic for people. And yet it is a very important problem that we as a legislature really need to solve. And so the real question I think that's before us is whether we can put politics aside and solve this problem for the state of Minnesota and our citizens. And I am here to ask you to please do that and to work together, which we must do if we're going to get anything done on this topic, this session, or ever. We have to do it bipartisanly, and there's just no other way that this can be handled. And I know that some people think that we should just do nothing, because you all are aware that there's a lawsuit going on in federal court. And so I suppose that it is an option to just do nothing and wait for the court to act. But I think that's a very, very poor option. It's obvious why we would want to do that. It would be much easier to just duck this topic. It's a very difficult topic. We know that this is a very potent campaign issue, and anybody who votes for anything that can be spun as being soft on crime, and especially soft on sex offenders, that everybody worries that can be used against them in a campaign, and that is a very real worry. We're all worried that we're going to go home and somebody's going to say to us, you did something that put me in danger. We all feel that way, because this is something that the public is rightfully very concerned about. But we as legislators didn't come here to duck important and difficult issues. I think that if we duck this issue and simply say that the courts will do it for us, that we will be shirking our duties as legislators and, in fact, violating our oath of office. Because we all take an oath to support the Constitution, of both the federal Constitution and the state Constitution. And what we have now is not constitutional in the view of many, many people. And we know this not just because I say so, but because, you'll hear from Chief Justice Magnuson, he can speak to that with a little more authority than I can. But if we believe that we have problems in our system, even if we don't believe they're unconstitutional, it is our responsibility to fix them. The other reason why we must not shirk this responsibility is that if we leave this to the court, we may be putting the safety of our citizens at risk. And the reason I say that is because there is no guarantee that the federal court will not solve the problem by saying, shut this program down. Now, that is perhaps a small risk. I don't know. The Chief Justice can talk about how likely he thinks that might be. But if that should happen, because we failed to act, that would be a responsibility on us, and we would have put public safety at grave risk. And finally, one of the reasons that we must not shirk our responsibility here is that we would, in fact, be turning over our sovereignty to a federal court. This is our program. It's a program that we pay for, and we cannot turn over to the court. We cannot just say, come on, court, do our job for us. In many different contexts, members of this body, and I'm sure the Senate as well, work to protect our sovereignty as a state. Now, we sometimes disagree about what that looks like, but I think we all agree that as Minnesotans, as the Minnesota legislature, it's our job to defend the sovereignty of Minnesota within our federal system. And if we simply say, let the court do it, we're basically saying that on this issue, at least, we don't care about our sovereignty. And I am not willing to do that. So, you know, before we go into particular questions, I just want to lay that out there, because, as I have said before, if we're going to roll call this bill, if we're going to politicize this vote, we're simply not going to do it. And then whoever is asking to politicize it, those risks and that potential violation of our sovereignty is going to be that person's problem. Because I and many other people have worked on this issue, and it is a tough issue. It's tough politically, it's also tough substantively, and it's tough in terms of its finances, and the commissioner can talk about, they work very, very hard to get this to work fiscally for us and to take a step forward. The other thing I want to say is that what we're doing in this bill is really not such a big change. We are not changing the standards by which people get into the program or the standard by which they come out of the program. What we are doing is improving the program to make sure that it does what it is constitutionally mandated to do, and that is to give real treatment to people with a realistic opportunity that they can succeed in treatment and then move forward and get out of the program. Because remember, the people in this program are not serving a sentence of conviction. They are in the program solely because they're considered too dangerous to be out without treatment. And they're put there to be treated. Now, obviously, some of them will never be treated and will never be able to get out. We all know that, for whatever reason that is. But there are people in the program who can be treated and who do deserve an opportunity to move forward. And if we say that that's not the case, then the court will say we don't have a real program and will likely tell us the program is done or will reform it in a way that we may not like. So thank you, Madam Chair. And if there are questions, or I can turn it over to the Chief Justice.
Representative Liebling, first I want to let members know that right now what's being handed out is a new fiscal note. This is based on the Senate language, so this is the Senate's fiscal note. So that's the new language based on the amendment that you have before you. Is that correct, Representative Liebling?
That's correct. I think so. This is the most recent based on that is consistent with the amendment that's before the committee.
All right. So, members, I'm going to let you look at that for a second. I just want to see in the audience, who's here to testify for or against this bill? Okay. Just one. All right. So, members, I announced this before everybody was in the room. It is my intention that we're going to hear this bill. We're going to ask every question that needs to be asked. We're going to let everybody testify that wants to testify. The majority of this committee has to be in rules at 9:30. So whatever we don't finish this morning, we're going to come back and finish after session. So, Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, a lot of us in the minority struggle with this bill, and Representative Liebling, you introduced in your opening statement, painted a political statement within your opening statement and suggested that if people have problems with the content of the bill, that you are ready to paint them with the political outcome, with political consequences for that. I want you to know that those of us in the minority struggle with this bill, with the fact that the minority has not had input into the development of this bill. And Representative Liebling, I understand that back in March when it was heard in HHS policy that you and Representative Mack had a discussion about the bill and there was an offer to work together to make improvements to address the concerns brought forward and understood by the minority. As I understand, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, Representative Liebling, but as I understand it, there has not been that discussion. There has not been an effort to improve the bill that includes input from the minority. And Representative Liebling, Madam Chair, if we're going to move forward, and I'm going to tell you right now, Representative Liebling, I'm prepared to call for a roll call when we get there. Because we have not had the input that is necessary into this bill in order for us to believe that we are best protecting the public safety of Minnesota. And we can go through and Madam Chair, and have a hearing today and do the expedited committee work that seems to be the norm around this place in the last few weeks here prior to us even having a budget before us. As I understand, there's a bunch of conference committees that should be meeting a lot harder than they are. Representative Liebling, if you're going to attempt to bully the minority and our ability to and prevent our ability to provide substantive foundational input into the development of this bill and the understanding that goes with that, go ahead and try to bully us, but we are looking out for the public safety of Minnesota and don't believe that we have had the type of input we need to be able to provide into this bill in order for us to support it going forward. So, Madam Chair, you guys have the majority on the committee as you do in the legislature. There's 9 of you and 6 of us, but I've talked to each of the members of our caucus on the committee. We're not comfortable going forward with the bill as it is today. Without a deeper both understanding of the bill going forward, as well as an opportunity for us to provide some fundamental input into the bill going forward, which I believe is going to take a lot more work than us going through, again, an expedited hearing before and after session here on Friday, 10 days before the close of session. So I would just leave it with that and leave it in your court as to how, Representative Liebling, how you'd like to proceed.
Well, Representative Druskowski, let me just make it clear. This has not been an expedited hearing in this committee. We heard the bill, let the author walk through the bill in its entirety, let members know that I knew that an amendment was late, that we would not vote on it, that we would lay it over, and it has been weeks that the bill has been laid over. We then had an opportunity to offer amendments. I would note that there are none from anyone except Representative Liebling. And so we all have some responsibility here that if we want to participate in the process, that we actually have to do that as well. So I understand your concern, and I understand where you are, but I just want to make it really clear that I've said that we can be here. We have till midnight tonight to ask as many questions as you want to ask, to talk about anything that you want to talk about. But at the last hearing, we ran out of questions for people to ask. There was no one that was going to step forward and testify, and no one had any additional questions to ask before our time was up. So I just want to make that clear that we do have an obligation to actually do the work, and that is the job of this committee, and we will. And so if we got to sit here till midnight to make sure we vet this issue, we will. Representative Cornish.
Well, Madam Chair, I've worked on this issue for some time with the parties involved here. At the end of the hearing, you aren't going to have one Republican vote. And on the floor, you're only going to have one. I doubt if the DFL is going to call this up on the floor for a vote. So what I'm saying is you'd be a lot better off spending your time ending a hearing at this point and continuing this on next year. Otherwise, we're going to sit here and we're going to come up with the same vote.
Well, Representative Cornish, we're going to hear the issue. So, Representative Druskowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would recommend, Madam Chair, that we consider an effort in the interim that would be a – this is a very important and very fundamental public safety concern for the people of Minnesota, and how we approach this, I think, is very, very, very important, more important probably than anything that we've addressed this week on the House floor. And so I would suggest we endeavor to have a bipartisan legislative group of some sort appointed by you or someone to in-depth dissect this issue, its history, and its future, and put forward an effort that contemplates not only this bill and Representative Liebling's efforts that she's put forward, but also input from the minority through that process, one that would be robust in its level of time and energy that's put into it, as well as the amount of detail in analysis and development of the bill going forward. And we come back next session with a bill that can receive bipartisan support, one that we can feel very good about, the one that Minnesota can feel very good about.
Thank you, Representative Druskowski. Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And one of my concerns in this is not only that we haven't been at the table with this issue, but I believe there's at least one other study or recommendations that are waiting in the lurch on this issue. And I don't know what the big hurry is here, that we can't do this next year after the process has been more thoughtful and we'll have more data to use for this important issue. So I just wanted to put that out there as saying I think we need more information. We need as much information as we can possibly get on this issue because, you know, we know what's at stake. And are there members of the public here? We have one person to testify. But I can guarantee you that every family in my district cares about this issue. And every family in every district of everyone sitting around this table cares deeply about this issue. And they want us to make the decision with as much information and as much thought as possible. Thank you.
I look forward to hearing from all of you today about the issues that we need to make certain that we highlight and look at, because we'll be sitting here. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And you know, members, I fully appreciate the difficulty of this issue in terms of how your constituents will feel about it. You know, that is why we do have to proceed carefully with this issue. But I really want to respond to Representative Drazkowski's assertion that the minority has not had input. First of all, there is a task force that was appointed by the court that includes Senator Limmer and Representative Abler, and I believe Representative Abler is a co-author on this bill. Also, as the chair mentioned, this has been out there, and everybody's known about it for about a month at least, I think, since we had that last hearing. And in that time, no member has approached me with a concern about any particular part of this bill. So to say that the minority has not had input, I don't know what that would mean in terms of if I'm supposed to go and talk to every member of the minority. Bill, this is how things work around here. The bill is out there. People have an opportunity to look at it. This committee in particular had an opportunity, knew this was on the table, and there have been, I think, multiple discussions with the Chief Justice as well. So absolutely the minority has had input here. And absolutely I welcome your input. We really need to do this in a bipartisan way. But I would also, in terms of what the big hurry is here, I think it's clear that we do have a big hurry. And when the legislature has tried to work on this issue for many years, and Representative Cornish knows that very well. He's worked on this himself. And we never seem to get there. And we never seem to get there because it is a very difficult political issue. But we do have a big hurry, and we have a big hurry this session. And that is that if we don't act, the federal court probably will. And the Chief Justice can address this issue, but it is very questionable whether we will get to next session before the court acts instead of our acting. So, in fact, there is a big hurry this session. The other thing I would like to ask, Madam Chair, I hope the minority members will tell us what part of the bill is a problem for them. If there is a particular part that's troubling to you, we would like to know what that is because we want to address those concerns. This is not something, you know, the minority talks a lot about being marginalized and not having enough input, not just in this context, but in many. And I've been in the majority and I've been in the minority. I know how that feels. I've been in the minority twice. I know how that feels. This is one of these issues where you have an opportunity to shape this legislation. You absolutely do. But what you can't do is just say, we're not participating, no, 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 it's never good enough. Because if that is your answer, and that has been the answer over many years, it's never good enough. If you don't tell us what it is that isn't good enough so that we can fix it, then clearly it's going to be interpreted by many, Representative Drazkowski, as just pure politics. So I hope that's not the case. I really invite your serious input into the policy here. We all want to make sure that Minnesotans are safe.
Well, we actually need to get into the policy. We have 30 minutes before the majority of this committee needs to be in rules, and we can keep talking all day. So, Representative Liebling, with the one person that's in the room that wants to testify, we want to make sure we save time for them, and we want to have members have so much questions. So you tell us what it is that you think we need to know, and we'll hear from the person that wants to testify, and then we're going to open it up for as many questions as members have. Representative Liebling.
All right. Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And so I think members have, having had this bill before us for the committee for quite a while, I think the members know the general idea here. We're changing the process in the beginning, the commitment process, not by changing the standard. So the standard for commitment remains the same. But we now have in the bill a bifurcated system where there will be first a consideration of whether the person meets the standard for commitment, which may in fact cause an increase in the number of commitments or a decrease. We don't know that. It is not intended to impact who gets committed. After that, there is a waiting period during which the person gets an evaluation, and that evaluation comes back to court for the court to consider what kind of placement the person needs both for their treatment needs and for the requirements of keeping the public safe. Secondly, the Commissioner of Public Safety will be setting up what we're calling strict and intensive supervision and treatment, which is another kind of other levels of treatment that are not either in our Moose Lake or St. Peter facilities, which will allow for a range of treatment. Both initially, the court could place somebody in that what we're calling SIS, strict and intensive supervision and treatment, okay, or they could go to the more secure facility.
Representative,
just want to make sure. Did you say Commissioner of Public Safety or Human Services?
I'm sorry, maybe I misspoke.
Human Services?
I misspoke. This is Human Services.
Okay. Representative Labeling.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative Paymar. I didn't want to make that mistake. No, she's sitting right here, and this is who we're talking about, Commissioner Jessen, at this time. So the Department of Human Services would be setting up these facilities, and that is a part of this bill as well, is authorizing them to do that. And they've already begun that process, and she can talk more about that. So this ensures that we're able to deal with a range of people, committed people, in a range of circumstances with facilities and treatment and security that meets the needs of each of those people and of the public. Then we have a new review procedure where we have this independent panel of examiners, and as I explained at the beginning, they would be sort of a check to make sure that those who are doing the treatment are actually providing treatment. We know that some patients will never be treated. We know that some of them will never cooperate in treatment. But there are others who will, and we need to make sure that the treating professionals are doing their job by having this independent check on that. So every 2 years, every patient would get a review, a paper review. There would be an independent examination looking at all of their treatment records, and this would be submitted to the court, which would then decide whether there's enough there to have a hearing. If the court thinks there's enough there, a prima facie case has been established to have a hearing, then the court would have a hearing, and the county attorney would come in and have input, and it would be a full hearing, and the court would make a determination of whether the person stays where they are or can move to the next level. We are not changing the procedure or the standard for someone leaving the program for provisional discharge. That all remains the same. These changes are totally within the program so that we can assure the federal court and ourselves that we have a real treatment program and not just a way to lock people up forever, which appears to be what we have right now. So I think that covers the main issues in the bill, and Madam Chair, maybe we should give Chief Justice Magnuson a chance to say a few words.
Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record and go ahead.
Good morning, Madam Chair. Eric Magnuson, and good morning to the other members of the committee. I've had the privilege now of testifying several times before bodies of the legislature on this topic, and I always welcome the discussion. The linchpin from a constitutional standpoint of civil commitment, of locking people up because you're afraid they may do something bad in the future, is establishing that they have an illness and that you're going to try and treat it. There have been at least 4 in-depth studies of this issue over the past decade. In 2005, the commission appointed by Governor Tim Pawlenty issued a detailed report pointing out the problems with the civil commitment process in Minnesota. And one of those problems is the treatment is not effective. It's not mandated by the courts. It's not mandated by legislature. It doesn't work. The legislative auditor in 2011 issued a similar detailed report. I believe we provided them to you. I know that they are all on the website of the task force. My task force, with over 20 members, including members of the legislature, sitting judges, retired judges, prosecutors, defenders, mental health professionals, have studied all of those prior studies. We've taken testimony, and we have been acutely aware of the proceedings in the federal court. That's why we got appointed. The federal judge said, look at three things. Look at how people get into the system, look at how they're treated while they're in the system, and look at how they get out of the system. But the federal judge said, look first at the middle issue. How are people treated? Because if you don't change that, to me the message was, then the rest of the system fails. Because you can't keep people locked up without effective treatment. We spent hundreds of hours reviewing this issue. We submitted a report in December outlining the changes that we thought should be made to address that first point. As Representative Liebling said, this legislation is really relatively modest. It changes a little bit of the procedural front end so that a judge now has the ability to place someone at a more appropriate facility so that they can be treated more effectively rather than this maximum security. And it sets up a mandatory program of not only treatment but reviews so you ensure that people go through the treatment system. Now, those are relatively minor. They don't change, as the representative said, the standards for commitment or the standards for release. But they are vitally important in the context of the constitutional litigation. There's no constitutional question that you can civilly commit someone who poses a threat to the community. And there's no constitutional issue with releasing them. But if you don't have an effective and demonstrably effective treatment program that allows people to transition through, you're not going to pass constitutional muster. Federal court, I believe, based and consistent with all the prior studies, is pretty inclined to declare that the system is unconstitutional from a treatment standpoint. So that needs to be fixed, and it needs to be fixed now. One of the things we've struggled with in our task force is focusing on that issue and not wanting to reach out and address the bigger issues. I agree with those who express the sentiment that this is a complex issue and requires more study. But it also, at this point in time, requires some action in order to maintain the constitutional viability of the program. And a federal court will not revise this program. It will not fine-tune it. It will not say, well, if you do this and this and this, it will be better. It will simply say, constitutional, not constitutional. If it's not constitutional, you've got no authority to hold these people. Now, I'm not saying that Judge Frank is going to release all 670 people, but in California, and I've said this before to this committee, when the California legislature couldn't get together and fix the problems with their prisons, the federal judge said, okay, you can't keep people there. Let them go. And you just cannot expect the federal court to resolve this problem in any detailed way. You can expect it to vote thumbs up, thumbs down. And if the legislature doesn't take action this session, then the court's going to consider that. It's got a lawsuit it's got to resolve. Courts don't sit on lawsuits waiting for states or parties in their own good time to resolve the issues. If the legislature doesn't do it, the federal court will. Thank you.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and maybe we should allow Commissioner Jessen to say a few words as well, since she's a pretty important party in this whole thing.
Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record and go ahead.
Madam Chair, I'm Lucinda Jessen, Commissioner of the Minnesota Department of Human Services. Thank you for letting me say a few words this morning. I mostly was here to answer any questions about the fiscal note or kind of any technical questions. I do appreciate the opportunity to say a few words. First of all, I do want to let you know, Madam Chair and members, that the department is vigorously defending the state in this lawsuit. So while I don't disagree with the procedural characterization that Chief Justice Magnuson has just laid out, you know, and certainly, you know, respect his opinion, I do want you to understand that. But we are also, at the same time, kind of recognizing the risks here, trying to work very diligently to try and improve matters, including the treatment that's being provided. After we received, as Justice Magnuson said, the task force made their first recommendations in December, and those recommendations were to the legislature and the department to develop these strict and intensive supervision and treatment facilities. In other words, to have more of a continuum, not so that when judges are deciding or after a judge makes a decision to commit someone to this program, that the judge has more than one option, because right now the only option is Moose Lake. So I did want to let you know that we did then in January issue a request for information to public and private providers around the state, and actually sent it and received some from around the country asking what would you do? Tell us what you would do, you know, other options you could provide to care for people to make sure that the public safety is taken care of, but also that they receive treatment and in hopefully for some of these people in a less expensive fashion. The fiscal note, if you want me to just very quickly, do an overview of that, reflects our sense. So as far as the what we see is the immediate cost in the next biennium of developing the strict and intensive supervision and treatment facilities to at least start to develop some options for courts other than just the most expensive one. But we took a look at per diems of these other options. And as you'll see in the fiscal note, we think that some of these actually would be more expensive than Moose Lake, because some people are going to be more expensive to make sure that we meet the public safety as well as the treatment needs. And some people could be placed in facilities that would be less expensive than we have at Moose Lake. Our overall take was, for the next biennium, we think that we could manage those costs within the proposed budget, including the increase for MSOP that's already in the House bill as well as the governor's proposed budget. There's an increase based upon the fact that every year about 55 new people come into this program. There's a per diem cost. There's almost about $8 million for the next biennium. We think we could manage the development for the next 2 years of, you know, having more of a continuum, starting to build that continuum to give judges choices other than only one within that that what's already built in as the increase for MSOP. Where there are additional costs is the second part of what Representative Liebling described as part of this legislation, and that's the second part is to make sure that everyone in this program is assessed at least every 2 years. Now it's more at the client, if the client petitions for provisional discharge or transfer, then we do an assessment. But there's not built into the current system an assessment to see how they're doing in treatment on a regular basis. This bill requires everyone to be assessed at least 2 years, and as Representative Liebling said, for that assessment, then that evaluation, to go to the Supreme Court Appeals Panel for them to look at it on paper, and if they think a hearing is required, to have that hearing. So there are some additional costs because we need to hire new assessors. These would be independent assessors to do the assessments, and there's some court costs, which we at DHS would be reimbursing the court for those costs. So that's why you see the fiscal note, which comes in for fiscal year about $728,000 in FY14 and $960,000 in fiscal year 15. So those costs are for mostly for the additional evaluations, as well as some of the what we see as some additional court costs. I'm happy to answer any questions about the fiscal note. There is one other small part in the bill. The bill talks about education relating to these changes. We would absorb that. We already do education with the counties, and that would just be part of our ongoing efforts of the department. There would be a small cost for the public education campaign, which is called for in this bill. Our thought is to hire a retired judge to help us with that. So we project a cost of about $4,000 a year.
All right. So, Representative Cornish, before I know that you have a question, but before we go to that question, we want to make sure that anybody in the audience has an opportunity to testify this morning, because we're all going to be here, and I want to make sure that anybody that made a special trip to come to testify, that we get them in. So, Representative Cornish.
I can save it until after, and then I'm prepared to present you a plan that the GOP might accept.
All right. So, is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify for or against this proposal? Please come to the table, state your name for the record, and go ahead.
Good morning, Madam Chair. My name is Donna Dunn. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Coalition Against Sexual Assault, and I'm here to support the work that Representative Liebling has done. I represent over 70 rape crisis centers across the state of Minnesota who clearly are concerned about public safety and concerned about the long-term vision of how we as a state respond to sexual violence. I serve, in fact, on the task force that has been mentioned here today, and part of my role there is to continue to raise issues that I know will come up in terms of what victim survivors might be looking for and the questions about public safety. I feel quite confident that this doesn't answer all of the questions that have arisen around this very complex issue, but I see that this is a very moderate and step actually in the right direction to get us started, to have the deeper and longer conversation about how we respond to sexual violence in Minnesota. So I'm pleased to support it. I'm also very pleased to hear Representative Liebling's commitment to the larger and more comprehensive issues that this task force and others will continue to address within the next months and years. So thank you very much.
All right. Does anyone have any questions for Ms. Dunn? Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Ms. Dunn, on this Friday. I'm just curious, your membership, the folks that are involved in your organization throughout the state, have they seen this proposal? Do they know what it does? Have they had a chance to provide input into it? It seems to me that, anyway, I'll let you answer the question.
Ms. Dunn.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative? Senator?
Representative.
Sir, thank you. I have kept our membership briefed on the conversations that have been happening at within the task force, so they are aware of the court order, of the existence of the task force, of the pressing issues at the forefront, and typically they have not been in a position to really engage in some of the conversation about how we as a state manage sex offenders. They simply don't have the time. But I have kept them apprised of the nature of the conversation, the tone of the conversation, the fact that what we are looking at here doesn't change the level at which we understand the entrance into the program or how one gets out of the program. It simply is shifting our focus and how services might be provided for somebody who is civilly committed. And those who have responded are very aware of that, yes.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay, other questions for Ms. Dunn? Anyone else in the audience who wishes to testify for or against this bill? All right. Okay, members, then we'll take... Thank you, Ms. Dunn. We'll take questions for the other testifiers. So, Representative Cornish, you had a question.
No, I didn't have a question. If you're all done with the questions, I'll give you a plan.
Okay, well, we've got some questions, I think. Questions from members. Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. First of all, I'd like to formally put the roll call on, if I could, Madam Chair, for when we do get to that point.
Okay, so Representative Drazkowski, are you asking for a roll call in the adoption of the A6 Amendment, or are you asking for a roll call on the final bill? Representative Drazkowski.
On the final bill, Madam Chair.
Okay, so Representative Drazkowski, do you have any objection then we're just going to take the vote to put the A6 Amendment on the bill to get the bill in the shape the author would like it.
Thank you.
All right. All right, so at this point, the chair would move the A6 amendment to get the bill in the shape the author would like it. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. All right, so questions? Members, questions? Representative Paymar.
Well, Madam Chair, I have to go back in my office and look at all my research that I've done over this in the past, but Mr. Chief Justice, you were talking about the legislative auditor's report about the failure of the treatment program at MSOP, and so I'm wondering, I didn't see anywhere in this bill, and maybe this is a question for you, Commissioner, but I'm just trying to figure out how we ensure that we have the most effective sex offender treatment possible at the MSOP facility as well as at the Department of Corrections, but I don't see that anywhere in the bill that talks about treatment or perhaps providing more resources to ensure we have. Because that's what, I mean, at the end of the day, that's what the public wants to know, that the
if offenders are being, or patients are being moved to a less restrictive area, that they are have met that treatment criteria. So if someone could respond to that, maybe it would be helpful.
Justice Magnuson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Paymar, the way things work right now, you go to Moose Lake, and then if you want to move out of Moose Lake as a committed person, you have the obligation to make your case. It's basically, instead of innocent until proven guilty, you're guilty, prove that you are less guilty now and should move someplace else. The treatment models don't work very well, some of them in a very high security environment. You need to have increasing responsibility on the part of the committed person, and that's why you need all the studies have recognized you need a transitional, you know, kind of a flow. What this does is it gives the committing court the chance to put people in a more appropriate location. It puts in place a process by which the committed person's progress is evaluated on a regular basis, as opposed to somebody, you know, just sitting there, and if they don't do anything, nobody moves them. And those two steps will, while they don't address the kind of medical, psychological side of the treatment, they present a framework by which that progress is going to be measured and evaluated regularly. So that's a huge step. You know, the design of the treatment program is really DHS, and that is something I can't address. But this does what needs to be done in terms of getting a process. And I think that's why I tried to emphasize that this is really a relatively modest step. There's more work to be done.
Follow-up, Representative Paymar?
Well, I don't know. Maybe the commissioner wants to respond to that, because I do think that's a sort of a problem, because, you know, whatever cognitive behavioral approach is used in your treatment model at MSOP, or for that matter, the DOC sex offender program, these individuals are still being incarcerated in a facility. And so there is not really an option to observe them outside of that facility. So I'm trying to figure out if the treatment program was deemed a failure, which I thought it was, or had problems in MSOP, what's going to change now? And is that just another step after this is implemented?
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Representative Paymar. Since the legislative audit, the legislative auditor had several criticisms of the treatment program, which actually were similar to concerns raised by the department in its report as well. A number of those have been addressed as far as making sure people have more treatment hours, things that are within DHS's control, making sure we had more treatment, counselors and providers, and there was more treatment being given. We also had an annual assessment from an annual team of experts come in every year and comment upon what's working and what needs to change in the program. So there are changes that we've been making within the treatment program to improve the treatment that's being received. I think really what this bill does, though, there's some changes we can make within the program, and there's some changes that are in statute. And I think what this does is, as the Chief Justice said, make sure that you get that outside look and say, how is this working for this individual? So that it's not just by the individual that petitions, but it's really giving the courts a lot more oversight on a regular basis over the treatment being provided in this program. You know, and that's oversight that's only sporadically happening at this point. You know, when we looked at other states that have sex offender treatment program, you know, have that oversight by the courts, often it is that typically, it might be the committing court once a year has the person come before them and review what's going on. So this puts that at every other year at a different place, the Supreme Court Appeals Panel, but it does provide that evaluation check, which is missing from the system today.
Other questions from members? Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The fiscal note doesn't contain any data, or maybe I've missed it, on what this is going to cost the counties. And if the commissioner would like to address that, that'd be great. Thanks.
Commissioner Jessen.
Madam Chair, Representative Scott, at this point, counties pay either 10% or 25% of the cost of an individual that's committed to MSOP. And that depends. 2 years ago, the legislature increased that county share from 10 to, I think, to 25% for people committed after that time. So that's why it varies a little bit. This does nothing to change the county share. So that county share would apply whether someone's for someone who's committed to MSOP, if they're committed to Moose Lake, they'd be paying, if it's newly committed, 25%. If they were committed to a different, to MSOP, but put in a CIS facility, they'd be paying that 25%. So it doesn't change the county share, the county payments in this bill.
Follow up, Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And who decides and how is it decided where, you know, if these people aren't in Moose Lake and they're put in some alternative facility for this strict and intensive treatment, if I'm understanding this right, you know, who decides where this housing or whatever goes? Because no one's going to want this in their neighborhood.
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Representative Scott, the Section 1 of this bill, which directs me as commissioner to develop these facilities or other places. I understand very much, Representative Scott, that is an important issue. And actually, the task force has made recommendations about making sure that facilities are really geographically, spread around the state. And it's made some suggestions that perhaps Justice Magnuson would want to refer to. But I'm certainly, looking at those issues would be an important part of the process because, I very much understand those concerns.
Justice Magnuson, did you want to add anything to that?
Madam Chairman, Representative Scott, we're very aware of that issue. The alternative is to put it all in one spot. And burden that community, and that is not part of what our final recommendation is. We're still trying to evaluate. We need to see what the response is, and then we can address that. But it was our recommendation that the burden should be spread around the state. It will lower the cost. It will give the opportunity. Part of this is also involves an educational component, making the communities aware of the problem and the effort to solve it, I think, will be beneficial to all.
Representative Scott, a follow-up?
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair. And to Commissioner Jessen, I think you mentioned an amount for what it would cost for this public, letting the public know this this program, to let the public know what's going on. What was that amount again?
Commissioner Jessen.
Madam Chair, Representative Scott, I believe it was $4,000. I'm just looking at the specifics here. And that was... Yes, $4,176, and that was by working with a retired judge to help us with that.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That is just developing the program, the cost for developing the program, because implementing is going to cost way more than $4,000.
Commissioner Jessen.
Madam Chair, Representative Scott. That $4,100 was really just about the public education campaign, which is referred to in Section 3. Certainly I understand the development of this, of the whole program, this kind of new CIS program, will cost more than $4,000. And that was what I was trying to say, Representative Scott, that while certainly there will be time and money spent in developing the CIS program, we think that we can use the funds that are already in the House bill for the increased cost to cover that. Some of the costs will be for individuals would be more, some will be less. We think there's the opportunity to have some long-term savings, but at least we think we can manage that the cost of developing this within the growth that's already projected for this program.
Follow-up, Representative Scott? Oh, okay. Further questions from members? Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just on that point, Commissioner, it sounds like the full amount of rolling out the education program hasn't even been contemplated in the fiscal note, and the thought is, well, maybe we'll find money in the budget. Is it part of the fiscal note, and was it part of the budget proposal?
Commissioner Jessen.
Madam Chair, Representative, in the governor's proposed budget, which I believe is in the House, the budget, HHS budget that passed the House as well, we proposed an increase of almost $8 million next biennium for MSOP. That was based upon the fact that we project, because we've had about 55 individuals, you know, join on average every year, be committed to the program, and the costs were based upon a per diem of $326 a day. So that was basically the math that went into that. So when I talk about, so if we're developing a program which would provide options, you know, there are certainly some unknowns there. It's possible we'll have more people committed. It's possible we'll have fewer people committed. But we think that we can manage the development for the next 2 years at least of this SIST program within that projected increase. The public education campaign, you know, certainly with more money, you know, we could do more. We think, though, that this, as far as talking about the specifics of this program, you know, the sex offender treatment program, that working with a retired judge to go out and be talking with communities, talking with law enforcement about it, would be a good first step in the next 2 years as we develop this program.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, Commissioner, it was not a deliberate part of the budget proposal either. Is that what I heard?
Commissioner Jessen.
The education dollars.
Representative Drazkowski.
Okay.
Sorry, Madam Chair.
No, that's okay. Representative Drazkowski just clarified that question. So,
were the education dollars an identified part of the budget proposal?
Commissioner Jessen.
Madam Chair, Representative Drazkowski. I'm sorry. I didn't understand the original question. The governor's proposed budget did not include an amount for the public education campaign, if that's your question.
Thank you.
Representative Drazkowski.
So, Madam Chair, Representative Liebling, how the discussion about the halfway houses, and I don't know what we're calling them, I don't even know if they're identified with a name in the bill yet, but the discussion of these facilities for the intensive treatment folks, when are we going to know those details? I think this is, again, an example of wanting to know how everything fits together, not only myself, but I assume other members of the committee and probably the public as well. How can we move forward with all of this without knowing where all the pieces fit?
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for the question, Representative Drazkowski. I mean, I think it brings us to a place that we end up a lot in the legislature, which is there's a bit of a chicken and egg problem here. And so the commissioner has put out this request for proposal. She could address a little more specifically where she is with that. But the reality is that until she knows more specifically what's available, and as just like what we have now in our current program, you don't know what you need to provide until you know, until people start to come into the program. This is the problem. I think you have the same problem in corrections to some degree, although you have a lot more history there of who the, generally speaking, is going to be there and what their needs are going to be, both for security and otherwise. So, you know, it's really very hard to get started with anything that's at all new if you have to know every detail of everything. So I think the real safeguard that is inherent in what we're doing here and what we're changing is that this is going to be court-driven. And it's going to be court-driven with the assistance and input of the county attorneys. And Mr. Kerwin is here and from the County Attorneys Association, I believe. And he's been working with us very, very closely on this legislation. So this has been... put together by people who all have a deep interest in making sure that this works. And I think it's just really impossible to give a very deep level of detail, and I think it will never be possible to have this kind of legislation with a deep level of detail. And maybe the commissioner can give a little more specifics about where she is with this at this point and how she foresees moving forward with this.
Certainly, Representative Liebling, if I just might interrupt. Members, we've had a number of members that have had to leave for rules. I know that there are a few others that may have to go. So I would like to keep asking questions unless folks object to that. Otherwise, we can just come back after session, because we are coming back after session. All right. Commissioner, did you want to answer that question?
Madam Chair, we did receive 21 responses to our request for information from providers really all around the state of Minnesota, and some of them really were focused on our mentally ill and dangerous population, but most of them were actually making responses about what they could provide that would look something like this CIST program. They didn't give us a lot of cost information, so we need to get that and do an official request for proposals, which we are preparing. But actually, those responses, I believe, are public information. So for any member that wants to know about the sorts of things being proposed by providers, I'm happy to. We've got a summary. I have the responses themselves. But they really go from everything from kind of a more of a, what we heard in Texas they're doing, kind of a more halfway house model, to things that are actually even more secure than that. There are some models that were being proposed that were more like secure for if you think of the four-bedroom group homes that are being used in our adult foster care system, but that with more security around it and more treatment. So everything from kind of that smaller model to secured apartments, but with oversight and programming built in, to something that's more would look like a halfway house. They really ran the gamut, Madam Chair.
Follow-up, Representative Druskowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, Madam Chair and Representative Liebling, members, others, I think this is an area, an example of some of the apprehension that some of us have about moving forward without having this discussion about where the pieces fit. And, I don't want to be in a position of learning what this does after I vote for it. And, that's I think, a fundamental thing here. So with that, Madam Chair, I had some other questions, too. And that would be Representative Liebling. Fiscal note is probably 95% or 98% HHS. Is this going to HHS Finance? Are they going to review this? I would expect they would want to dig through this fiscal note in detail.
Representative Liebling.
Madam Chair, Representative Druskowski, I'm not really sure how to answer that question. I think that this could probably, as you know, the omnibus bill is still in the conference committee. I think it could be discussed there, but the intention was that this would be carried in the bill within, as the commissioner has discussed, that, and she let the HHS Finance Committee know this earlier on, I believe, when the whole budget was discussed, that it was her intention to cover those costs within the appropriation that's been requested. So I don't think the intention was to take this back to HHS Finance, because it is already kind of taken, the fiscal part is taken care of in the omnibus bill that's already there.
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, if I may clarify, Representative Liebling, the part that covers the option for strictive intensive supervision and treatment, that is part of the covered by what's in the HHS budget that the House passed. The evaluation costs, which includes some court costs, which are here in this bill, are not included at this time in the HHS bill that the House passed. So that is something that we would have to talk with. I would really look to your guidance, Representative Liebling, about what to do with that. I certainly have alerted the chairs of the conference committee about this, and they're very aware of what's going on here.
Representative O'Neill.
Madam Chair.
Excuse me, Representative O'Neill. Representative Druskowski.
Quick follow-up, but thank you. Madam Chair, those are again some of the struggles that I have with us moving forward in really this expedited end of session fashion. You know, we've already identified that the education rollout costs are not included either in the fiscal note or in the budget request. The details of this fiscal note and the ability and expertise of the HHS committee members to dissect the fiscal note to make certain that there aren't even additional costs, revenues or other things that are not part of this note and the proposal. I think the bill definitely needs to go there at some point prior to it getting to the House floor to make certain that that we've got all the I's dotted and the T's crossed. And so, I mean, we've identified a couple already, and I would hope that the bill does find its way there.
All right, Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to circle back, actually, to something Representative Haymar had just brought up, and that's about the treatment modality. And coming from that field myself, I'm gravely concerned. And also, within 5 miles of my home, there's a halfway house for sex offenders right now. And so, and I have a 16-year-old daughter, so you can imagine my great concerns and my community's great concerns about moving in this direction. You had just very briefly talked about the treatment modality as it existed and the movement and the direction that you felt would take it in a better direction, hopefully with more success. But the only thing I really heard substantive really was the fact that you added therapists and you added some hours. But did you actually change the treatment modality? And if you did, what was the treatment modality and what is the treatment modality in the future? And how will it change when you go into this less secure facility? And if you could just, for me, I think I've asked this question before and I didn't really get any answer as to what the treatment modality actually is. Can you explain that? And also, the last question I have is this a treatment modality that other states have used, and what success or not success have they had?
Commissioner Jessen.
Madam Chair, Representative, I have people here who with me who can probably answer your questions about treatment in a lot more detail than I can, Representative. That I think that certainly they did more than simply add hours, but that was actually, if you look at the legislative auditor's report, that was one of the legislative auditor's major criticism, that there weren't enough treatment hours. So that was one, I mentioned that because I think that was a major criticism of the report, and that was something that we did. As far, I can have people come down and discuss our treatment program, you know, and how people progress through it, and I'm happy to do that, Madam Chair. Let me just say, as far as the treatment in these other facilities, I think that we would really, that needs to be gauged by what that individual needs. And I think that we certainly, any of these CIS programs would have to have treatment programs that would have to be individualized for that person, that it wouldn't be kind of a cookie cutter treatment approach. But with that, Madam Chair, if you'd like, I can have someone come and discuss. And
if we could just hold off on that, actually. Did you have a question for the commissioner, or was this on the same line of Representative Johnson? Okay. Do you mind if we take, actually, Representative Johnson's? We actually do need to break here as well. So, Representative Johnson, and we'll come back to this. Representative Johnson.
Madam Chair, Commissioner, I as well have a lot of issues with the fiscal note. I believe there's quite a few things missing. You mentioned the SIST program, getting these halfway houses going. Do you know how many of these facilities we're going to need?
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Representative Johnson, one of the challenges is because how many people would be committed to the CIS program is really up to the courts. We don't, and so from what we would probably look to do is have some places available. We might be, you know, contracting with providers. We might be using our state-operated services to do that. But just, you know, that's part of what we would very closely look at in developing this. So how many we would need 2 years from now, 4 years from now, really depends very much on the courts. But we at least would like to have some placements available where we know that public that they are secure with appropriate treatment, so that if the court made the decision to that someone was better served outside of Moose Lake, there would be that place available. But it's hard for me to predict what courts would do.
Representative Johnson.
Okay, Madam Chair, Commissioner, You say that you program for approximately 55 new people in the program every year. Would you expect about half of them per year going into the system, or less than half, an approximation?
Commissioner Jessen.
Madam Chair, Representative, once again, that's really up to the courts. So that is really just not a prediction I can make, Representative. I do know, though, that when you're looking as far as the fiscal note, our cost of $326 per day at MSOP, you know, is significantly higher than, you know, than certainly than corrections, and as we learn, significantly higher than facilities in other these sorts of CIS programs in other states.
Representative Johnson.
Then also in that, which I feel is missing in this fiscal note, is for the intense supervised what I'm looking at is this going to be new employees that are going to be watching all these people, or is this going to be current employees?
Commissioner Jessen.
Madam Chair, Representative, when we put out our request for information, we asked for information from private providers who would be willing to do this, as well as, you know, public providers such as our state-operated services. So I think we would put our proposal would be to put out a request for proposal that would go to both private and public providers who've expressed interest in serving in providing these secure treatment facilities. So I think that would really depend upon both the responses we got to the RFP. We are not making an assumption that they would all be public employees.
Representative Johnson, then Representative Cornish.
Okay. Then there's a lot of costs that could come from this that are not in this fiscal note. It makes it very difficult for us to make a decision. This is information that we're going to need. Not only the 55 of the 55 placed every year, we need to know approximately what percentage are being going into these group homes, so we have an idea what the cost is going to be there, if we're going to need, how many FTEs are we going to have. Also, of the number that are already placed there, what part of them are going to be coming out and going into these facilities, increasing the number of facilities and employees that might be needed for them. Then the other question I have is, when these people are placed into the community, right now these public notification is going to be required. Having been involved in some of these notifications, they're not cheap to the counties. They're expensive. Notifying all these people, having the public hearings, are these public notifications going to be required, or are these people just going to be stuck in the community without the community knowing about it?
Commissioner Jessen.
Madam Chair, Representative, the community, this bill does not change any of the current community notification laws. Madam Chair.
Commissioner Jessen.
If I may, I apologize, but if I do not leave now, I'm going to miss the plane to my son's college graduation.
Okay, Commissioner Jessen, please go ahead. And members, we're going to be coming back after session, so I think this is probably a good place to stop. So at this point, I'm going to recess the meeting until to the call of the chair. We're in recess. Very Finance and Policy Committee meeting. Members, there is a roll call vote that has been requested. We're going to make sure that we take all the testimony that needs to be taken and ask all the questions that need to be asked, and we're going to vote tonight. So, members, we were taking questions from members. Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify for or against this bill? Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just wondering if you could point me, Representative Liebling, to the definition for less restrictive alternatives. To the definition for less restrictive alternatives. I looked through and I couldn't find one. Maybe I missed it.
Representative Liebling.
Madam Chair and Representative Scott, I don't think we use that term in this bill. We've created this CIS program, Strict and Intensive Supervision and Treatment, and that's a term that's used in other states. And you can, you know, I suppose one could say that it is less restrictive, but I don't think that term is used or defined anywhere in the bill. And members, if I may,
Representative Liebling.
Madam Chair. I just wanted to introduce Robin Vu Benson, who's from the Department of Human Services, and members. I think you heard this morning that the commissioner had to leave. She had a graduation in another state, and unfortunately, the Chief Justice wasn't able to stay. So Mr. Vu Benson is a policy person who's worked closely on this and hopefully can help answer questions.
All right. Other questions for members? Sorry. Did you have a follow-up, Representative Scott?
No, I'm good.
Okay, great. Sorry. Representative O'Neill.
So this is back to the question that I had asked earlier when we were together, and this has to do with the treatment modality, and I don't know if you can speak to that or not, but the current treatment modality, the modality that you're shifting towards, and what the modality would be in this less restrictive new plan that you have, if you could speak to that and how that compares to the success rate in other states, or if other states are doing this, any of those treatment modalities.
Representative Liebling, do you have someone that can answer those questions?
Well, I think so, Madam Chair, but, you know, first just let me say, though, I think, Representative, that we, I think as the commissioner sort of started to explain this morning, and I know she was pretty rushed, and we apologize for that, it kind of worked out that way at the end of session here, but we're not changing the treatment modalities in this bill, and what I heard her say, and Mr. Vu Benson can comment on it too, is that there might be different modalities that need to be used for different patients. And from my point of view, what's in the bill, there have been issues about this. This is a serious issue. But I took the approach as I was putting this bill together that we as legislators will have a really hard time telling the Department of Human Services what modalities to use. And apparently you have more experience with this, but I think most legislators, really, we don't have the expertise to sort of get in there and pick a modality or pick more than one modality. And so I've taken the approach in the bill that the way to make sure that the treatment is effective is to have this independent group of examiners who review each patient's progress at least every 2 years, and with the sort of the idea that everybody needs accountability, and that maybe what's been sort of missing is accountability, and that whatever modality is being used, that we'll have a group of experts who will be looking to make sure that whatever's being used is appropriate for that patient, and that time and money are not being wasted, and that if it's a failure of the person to want to be treated, that it's clear that that's the problem and not a problem of lack of expertise or resources or something on the part of the program. And I don't know if you, and we do have, Mr. Vu Benson, you might want to comment as well.
State your name for the record and go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Robin Vu Benson. I'm a Deputy General Counsel with the Department of Human Services, and I can address the question at least generally and identify some existing statements that are out there. The Legislative Auditor Report from 2011 in its chapter regarding the treatment program concluded that the types of treatment that are being provided are best practices or consistent with best practices, and did not question the types of treatment that are being provided. There was some question, as was stated this morning, about the number of hours or the amount of treatment that was available to clients, partly due to staffing situations. In terms of an ongoing process that the legislature put in place a number of years ago to ensure that the treatment part of the program was always going to be best practices. Every year there is a group of national, international sex offender treatment experts who visit both sites of the program, talk to therapists, talk to clients, do their own observations, review records, and they issue a site visit report with their conclusions about how the treatment practices in MSOP match known standards for treatment, and that's available as part of the sex offender program's annual performance report that's given to the lead members of the various committees, and is also on the website. They have not concluded that the type of treatment is inappropriate or inadequate. Some of their constructive criticism concerns delivery or some of the more detailed things, but certainly nothing to suggest that we've picked the wrong way of doing treatment.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And so moving forward then, if you're going to a different, less restrictive structure, can you speak to if anything would change, and if so, how that would change?
Mr. Vubenson or Representative Liebling, did you want to address that issue, Representative Liebling?
Well, I think Mr. Vubenson looks like he's ready to jump on that one.
Because I haven't been on the floor all day.
Mr. Vubenson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative, the in terms of the type of treatment that will be provided to individuals who are placed on this CIST kind of status, they will be receiving sex offender treatment that is consistent with what MSOP would be providing. It will be either through, of course, it's too early to say exactly what's how it will be done, but the anticipated probabilities are either there will be MSOP treatment staff who will be doing the treatment at these sites, or they'll be contracting with sex offender treatment providers that already exist and will be trained or coordinated with MSOP treatment practices to provide that kind of treatment to the individuals who are not in the facilities.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. just so that I can kind of wrap my brain around what exactly that you do there, do you have an underlying I won't say modality, but philosophy possibly that you use through the throughout the treatment? I realize that each treatment is individual, as it should be, but you know, is this based on that the sex offenders are sexual addicts, which is some theories in some circles, or you know, what exactly is would be the base by which you do treatment? Could you at least explain that much, or even if you want to go in a little more depth? I'm assuming you do groups and you do individual therapy and things like that, but if you could at least kind of explain the base from which you've built this system.
Mr. Vubenson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. There are groups, there are individual therapy sessions that are available for clients who need it. The primary modality, if I'm using the terms correctly, is cognitive behavioral therapy. Mm-hmm. There's a wide diversity among the patient population in terms of cognitive abilities or kind of needs, so there's adaptation to meet the client at their need, and that is the current literature is risk needs responsivity, where you identify and tailor your treatment to what is going to be what the client is going to respond to most effectively. But cognitive behavioral therapy is the overall primary approach.
Representative O'Neill.
Sorry, that just gets me down another. So there's not an overarching philosophy, so to speak, that these are that they are sexual addicts. Is that, would that be accurate then? You don't use that sort of philosophy?
Mr. Vubenson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I can't speak to that piece of it. Mm-hmm. There is a program theory manual that has recently been completed and updated that describes in detail, I think about 50 pages, single space kind of detail, of what the treatment philosophy of the program is and identifies its application in many ways. And we can certainly provide that to you to have that depth of articulation.
I would appreciate that.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you so much, Madam Chair. So if you're doing cognitive behavioral therapy, I'm a little confused as to how that treats a sex offender. So you're doing retraining of thought process to elicit different behavior.
Representative O'Neill, I don't want to, cut off any of your line of questioning, but, you know.
That'll be the last one. I just am trying to understand if they're doing, like a 12-step model like you would with an addict, and I don't think they are. And so cognitive behavior is a completely different understanding. So if I had that booked, I would help, but.
Certainly. And my only concern is most of us don't have that level of knowledge to even process the information, and this is judiciary, and so I'm trying to rein us in at least a little bit to talk about the judicial issues. But Mr. Vubenson, if you want to answer that question, and then we're going to go to Representative Johnson.
Okay. Well, for that question, it is beyond my knowledge base. We do have a clinician who would be able to address that now or would be available after the
hearing. I can certainly speak to him offline.
Okay.
Yeah. All right. Representative Johnson.
Madam Chair. A couple questions I have. First of all, when we started talking about this strict and intensive supervision treatment, I understand that's going to be like at a halfway house or something of that nature.
Representative Liebling.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Johnson, after we had our first part of our hearing this morning, people kind of reminded me that it's really not a halfway house. What we think of a halfway house, I think, is where people kind of come and go relatively freely and they come back for treatment and so on. This is not that. Nobody involved with MSOP is in any way calling this a halfway house. These are facilities that would be much more secure, where people would be much more monitored than that. And maybe Mr. Benson could, you know, add to that. And there would, I think, it's contemplated that there would be a range of facilities, because the idea being that at different stages of treatment, people might need different kinds of settings. But nowhere in this is it contemplated that it would be a halfway house.
Representative Johnson.
Okay, it's part of, Madam Chair, Representative Liebling, earlier today during when the commissioner was here, they talked about she'd received information from, I believe it was 21 different, I don't know if it was business or privately owned businesses or something on that nature. One issue that they might have in working with this program is a lot of these areas, when they get their permits for their operation, a lot of them are in the communities and neighborhoods, they have to have a conditional use permit under the specific operation of the business they're running. I can't think of anywhere in the state that any jurisdiction will allow a conditional use permit inside a neighborhood where there's kids present with these people. How are you going to handle that?
Representative Liebling.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Johnson, well, I certainly agree with you. In fact, I think in my first term I had an issue in my own community where the Department of Public Safety wanted to put, and it wasn't sex offenders, but they wanted to put a halfway house right in a neighborhood. And, you know, I was instrumental in getting that stopped. So obviously there are lots of places where it wouldn't be appropriate to put this kind of facility. But if we say that there's no place, then we're really in a pickle. I mean, and I know Mr. Benson, I'm sure, will want to comment on this as well, but some of the places that the commissioner, I know, talked to and got some information from are actually state-owned facilities. Others are probably facilities that are doing some types of this sort of work already, that it wouldn't be such a big jump. I don't think anybody's talking about going out and, you know, building a facility in the middle of a residential neighborhood. You know, none of us would find that acceptable. But if we take the approach that there is no place, then we're really stuck. And other states are doing this. I mean, it isn't like we're the only state. In fact, we're the state that hasn't been doing it. We're like the bad child among the states. We have kind of the least sustainable program, and that's why we're in the fix we're in. So other states have figured this out, and I'm sure Mr. Benson will want to comment on that because he's more familiar with those other programs than I am.
Mr. Benson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And if this is certainly an area that is difficult for communities, but is difficult for the state as well because of the need for these alternatives. The in terms of respecting local relationships, local ordinances, local culture, part of the RFI process for getting information from existing providers was to identify who is out there, who currently has relationships in their communities where they may be serving similar populations, certainly not not of the same level, but similar populations. And you know, that is something where when we receive the proposals, entities won't be making proposals that, or logically, an entity is not going to make a proposal that they can't follow up on. And they're going to be aware of their local environment. If they're already operating in a locality where they have developed trust with the neighbors, if they have a location that is away from children, away from playgrounds, and there are some of those locations out there that You know, we certainly don't have a full inventory of all of them, but this bill and the process respects what local governments and the local entities have done and have already established and are able to work with their stakeholders to establish.
Follow-up question, Representative Johnson.
Madam Chair, Representative Liebling, this comes back to the issue that we had earlier today, the fiscal note we received, the incomplete fiscal note. If it's state-run facilities or state buildings that aren't being used currently, these places have to be staffed. Then that's 24-hour-a-day staff, and not by one person, by multiple people. We're looking at a possibility of 200-300 more employees, plus social workers, caseworkers, psychologists, running around to all these places across the state. Some of these people are going to probably need if they're in not in Moose Lake, but in one of these other facilities, they might need meet with their psychologist every single day. We're going to have these psychologists running all over the state. Unless we hire, if we have eight facilities, we might need four or five more psychologists alone, plus their support staff. Right now, with the fiscal note we have, there's no way this bill should even be on this in this committee. We need complete information.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Johnson, that's an interesting kind of concern that I haven't, frankly, heard before, that somebody's saying that the fiscal note is too low. I appreciate that you're the implication that maybe we're not being told the whole truth here, but you have to remember that if we do nothing, we're not talking about starting some new program and taking a whole bunch of people who aren't currently and putting them in it. We're talking about managing a population that's already there and that's continuing to grow. So what's in the Health and Human Services fiscal note right now is to account for growth in the program, because we know that if we do nothing, this is a population that's continuing to grow, and the way we handle them now is very, very high cost. And so when you read through the fiscal note, you know, there is some uncertainty, because we don't know whether the courts will perhaps find more people committable than they do already, or we just there's a lot of things that you can't predict here about who's going to need service. And that's, we in our state, we have mostly in Health and Human Services, we have all these forecasted programs, which is sort of an educated guess about how many people will be in our program next year. Now, this one isn't a forecasted program, but there has to be sort of a guesstimate of how many people are going to be in it in future years, so they can have the facilities available. So when a court commits somebody, there's some place to put them. And so this is not in isolation, this fiscal note. It's taking account of the fact that we're already spending lots of money on these people, that a lot of the resources are already there, and the commissioner is asking to do something a little bit different with some of that. And so, you know, I think Mr. Bubenson can probably address more specifically the sort of the vision that you have. Or I know we all imagine these things differently, and obviously you're thinking of it as something where the treatment resources have to travel and that. And I kind of don't think that's the way the department is thinking of it. But Mr. Bubenson can.
If I could just welcome Representative Abler to the committee. He decided he wanted to join us today, and so if members have questions, I have Representative Paymar on the list as well, so I'll come back to you, Representative Johnson. But Mr. Bubenson, did you want to add anything to that answer?
I do.
Mr. Bubenson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to draw members' attention to pages 4 and 5 of the fiscal note, and I think, Representative Johnson, that may assist in getting a picture of at least the assumptions that were used in identifying the fiscal numbers as it pertains to this strict and intensive supervision and treatment. On page 5 of the fiscal note, there's a table there about three-quarters or toward the top that indicates the range of per diems. So as Representative Liebling indicated, there is possibility of a range of situations that we may be in. if there is no provider out there to provide a particular type of service for a particular subpopulation or in a particular geographic area, that's where there may be a lower efficiency in terms of the numbers of clients served and the number of staff or the number of providers who are even willing to be served. So that might be the high end, the 405 per diem. But there might be other situations, or at least we've worked on the assumption that there are other situations where there will be a lower cost because of efficiencies of scale, because of different needs of clients. So that's where there is the attempt to articulate the range of possibilities, but to account for many of them as well. In the items that are listed under the range of per diems, we have broken it down by the residential management, the supervision if the individual is on a work crew, the Office of Special Investigations is the DHS entity that provides supervision and surveillance and other services. The reintegration specialist is like the case manager and kind of probation officer rolled into one. We cover the rent, food, GPS monitoring. So we've attempted in providing this fiscal note to provide that level of detail, and we can certainly address any questions that are from that to provide some more background.
You want to follow up, Representative Johnson? Because I represent Paymar next.
I'll come back to that.
All right, Representative Paymar.
So my question is I have a question and a comment, but so if the patients are now treated outside of the MSOP program, will they then qualify under the Affordable Care Act for medical assistance if they're outside of the MSOP facility?
Mr. Bubenson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Paymar, it is somewhat speculative because we don't have, I don't think we have final eligibility details, but for someone who is not in an institution, which these individuals would be in something that doesn't disqualify them automatically from such coverage, they're most likely would be eligible under the MA expansion population. Because they would be not in those categorically excluded institutional settings.
Representative Paymar.
Well, Madam Chair, I just want maybe just a comment here, because I know that this is a difficult issue for the committee, but I, you know, the trend that we're on is just unsustainable, and Representative Liebling, I just really think you and Representative Avar, I know you were on the task force, and Judge Magnuson, and I mean, I just, I read most of the minutes from those meetings. I didn't attend them, and I know that you struggled with all of these issues, but we cannot continue we can't continue the cost at the MSOP. It's $120,000 for an offender to be there, and I represent Cornish, and I have talked about some alternatives that are not in this bill, but I think some of us would like to. So some of these offenders, frankly, should be housed in the Department of Corrections and get their sex, in my view, and get their sex offender treatment there, which would be a lot cheaper. Some of them can be in less, in my view, can be in less restrictive areas, and that is, it's going to cost the state less money. But you can, with this kind of per diem, with these kinds of numbers, we're one of 20 states with civil commitment programs for sex offenders. We have the highest number of civilly committed sex offenders per capita in the country. I just don't know how that we can continue at that rate. And, and so beyond the cost, I mean, if, as has already been stated, if the courts rule against the state, I fear this is going to cost a lot more. And I just think this is a very good first step, Representative Liebling. I'm quite confident that the department will be very, very cautious in who and how this program evolves. It was just like the, I think there's one sex offender from MSOP who has been released, right?
because I went to this, I went to the neighborhood meeting in Golden Valley, and it was tense. But I have to say that it was handled very well, and I know that the department is going, was very cautious with this individual, and I suspect if more patients are in less restrictive facilities, whatever neighborhood or city they might be in, especially at its inception, I think that the kind of monitoring that will go on, the kind of treatment that will be used for all of these patients, I think is going to be just top-notch with public safety at its very core, and I think we have to give this a chance. I think we need to take this first step, and I know people don't want to vote for this, they're concerned about it, but this is an issue that we have to be courageous about. So there's my little speech for tonight.
Other questions from members? Representative Johnson.
Madam Chair, Representative Liebling, I have a lot of concern with this program and with what's going on, and I do believe these cost numbers are extremely low. In fact, well, right now the cost number in this sheet, I have the numbers that Representative Paymar said at $120,000 a year to for the services provided at Moose Lake. That's right in the medium what these costs are now. The costs are going to be the same, and if we move in to this new thing right now, we're still going to have the same number of employees at Moose Lake. We're going to still have the same number of employees at St. Peter. But we're going to have to add employees. These numbers aren't including adding employees. And it's going to be a lot of employees to do 24-hour-a-day coverage for in these homes. We have a number of group homes where I live. They have 12 to 14 employees just to watch four people. And this is the type of numbers we're looking at. The numbers you're looking, the employee costs on this right now are sky high. The other problem that I see what's going on here is Chief Justice Magnuson explained it this morning. There's three parts to this study that was done. This is just one part of it. The other two are not in. Why are we rushing to this? When you're in court as an attorney, the question I have for you is, do you go with all the information or just a little bit? Or would you rather have all the information to make a clear, concise, proper judgment?
Madam Chair, if I may.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you. Representative Johnson, you know, I know that this is hard. You know, when we make policy, and I know you're in your first term, am I right? And it's hard. We make a lot of decisions around here without having complete information, because as policymakers, we often have to do things at a pretty high level. And I know that can be it can be uncomfortable, and I recognize that this is a particularly difficult area for that because of all the concerns that we all have about safety. But I think that what you heard from the former Chief Justice this morning and from the Commissioner, this is something that's been studied and worked on over many years, including by Representative Cornish and Representative Abler and others. And the why now is that we have a federal court telling us that we better do something. The issue about shouldn't we have done all three parts, I think one of the reasons, and Representative Cornish probably would agree with this, one of the reasons that perhaps the legislature hasn't been able to act in the past is that this is an enormously complicated problem, and when you try to solve all of it at once, it becomes undoable. So there are issues about that, in a lot of disagreement and controversy about the standard for committing somebody. And there's a lot of controversy about the standard for releasing somebody. And if I had a bill that tried to do all those things, believe me, you would not want to vote on that tonight. So what I've tried to do is pick an area that I believe will satisfy the court make this a constitutional real program without trying to attack those very complicated and extremely controversial issues. So this bill, again, deals with what happens in the program. The only thing it really changes about people getting in is this bifurcated, this two-step process. And the reason that we did that, and the reason I think the task force is very much agreed on that part of it, and I think even Representative Cornish had it in his bill before, the bifurcated process. Part of the problem that we face is that courts, and we hear this from courts, when somebody is petitioned for commitment and the court is making a decision, they know that if they make a decision to commit the person, that they are effectively right now committing them to a life sentence. And that may make courts hesitate. It's hard to really know, but that may make, if I was a judge faced with that decision, I would be extra careful. And so it may be that people who really do meet the standard don't get committed and get just sent back out again because there's nowhere in between for a judge to send them. So by having this two-step process, we make it, we think, possible for judges to make a less burdened decision, to look at the standard and look at the person and make a clear decision. So that may, in fact, mean that some more people are committed who wouldn't have been. On the other hand, you know, it may not. We don't know. But I think it serves public safety better to do it that way because we don't want judges to make those decisions based on other things other than whether that person meets the standard for commitment. So we're trying to really deal with just that piece and the piece about what happens when they get in there and what the treatment is and make it real treatment that will say to the court, we have a real program here. Let us do our own thing and don't interfere with our business. And that's kind of, and the fact that it isn't perfect, I wish it could be. We have been working on this for a long time. It is in no way rushed. There's been, I can't tell you how many hours I spent working with these people. I'm starting to feel like they're related to me, the whole team. We've spent so many hours together, and others have too, and our task force, many hours with Representative Abler, and this is in no way rushed or ill-considered. This is a very carefully thought-through program with, and although every single detail can't possibly be fleshed out at this point, it's not all going to happen on the first day either. In fact, if you look in the bill, there's a phasing of effective dates exactly because you can't all start it on the first day. But the problem is going to continue, and whether if we do nothing, we're going to have about 50 more people next year that are going to come into the program. So by doing nothing, we're not stopping the problem. We're just turning a blind eye to it.
Representative Abler.
Well, thank you, and I'm these little kid chairs you got in this room.
We can get you a big
chair. I'm happy. I'll try to be good. This is a really important topic, and the just to take a few things that were mentioned, just to the cause, well, I'll back up into the whole discussion here. Our treatment system for sex offenders, I would call it a failure. It was meant to be a 2-3-4 year program to get people to become safer. They'd be released. The people who are in this program, nobody wants for their neighbor. They are just, you know, they're not the neighbors you want. Unfortunately, they have certain constitutional rights. And I say unfortunately, you know, literally, but they have rights. And we swore to uphold the Constitution in our oath, and I've done it now 8 times. And I meant it each time. And so what does that mean? That means that we have to set up systems that actually are constitutional and work. And nobody, when they were passing this bill, would have said, oh, if we just throw them in there and leave them there for a lifetime, we'll be cool with that. The neighbors would be happy with that, and politically it would be perfect to do. And we continue to add on more sex offense times and severities. They passed with 134 green votes because we don't like to have these people in our neighborhood. Justice Magnuson said, you can't put people in jail just or in custody just because you're afraid of them. They have to be there for a status reason. And the reason these people committed a crime, heinous or multiple times, and they're terribly, terribly bad crimes. But a jury met, and they did a sentence, and they kept them in jail or prison for a certain amount of time, and their time got up. And then they, where time to release came, and then they got decided to be sent here because they thought they were still dangerous but could be improved upon because of their status. What's devolved to has been, it's based upon completion of treatment, not upon status. And so there are people who are almost done. Administrations changed, and they were upped for another period of time. And without regard to status, there's a case of a grandfather of one of these kids is my constituent. Just met him a month or two ago. This kid was 11 years old and did something terrible with his sister who was age 10. And it was a terrible act. But he was 11. He's now 26 years old, civilly committed, and has spent 15 years of his life in civil commitment. He went through some treatment programs and was just about done. He got to see his parents and do whatever, at least at Christmas, and now he's in this program and sees nobody. And so who cares? This kid did a dumb thing, terrible act. He's 11. Really, is that even a countable age? But nobody would say, if you're a judge and you're going to rule on this, whether this person should be in treatment anymore, why did you fail in this? You know, and what is his status? And that's the kind of cases. There's some other ones with 50 offenses and serial rapists and all that. And there are lawsuits pending. I don't know if they're going to come to fruition. There is a federal judge interested in this to the point that he's made some orders and some requests. Is he going to turn anybody loose? I don't know. But if I was a judge looking at the case of this kid, I would just, on those facts alone, say, really? I'm not keeping him there. Not keeping him there. And so how do we, in a more regulated way, decide how we should evaluate these people? Biennial review, really? That's like a liberalizing? If you're in a 2 to 4 year program and you have a biennial review, it sounds offensive and it sounds discriminatory to me. That's what this bill calls for, biennial review. And it says, so let's decide about the status. Right now, we sat in this committee. It's an august bunch of people. Fascinating and extremely knowledgeable, extremely experienced. I'm amazed that actually read the minutes, but I'm just honored to be in this group. Defense, prosecutors, judges. And so we've talked about how it goes. And what's happened is the department, they're trying to improve upon this, but they have not provided the judges with options about anything more than keeping the people there. Because they have not had, it's based upon completion time, because they didn't complete the treatment. And there's some people who almost got done, or they did it somewhere else, and they didn't want to do it, so now they're like not complying with this treatment thing. I might be one of those people. And so now I'm guilty of not completing treatment, and I get unhappy with being there for like a decade. And so you might start to get a little uppity. And now you're going to get up, it's an embarrassment to what we would say we do. We have the highest per capita people locked up there of any state in the union. Real impressive. And so I don't know how we can, as legislators, sworn to uphold the Constitution, do nothing with the threat of action or otherwise. We have a job to do. Is this a scary bunch of people to deal with? Is there a political peril in this? Absolutely. Could one of these people reoffend? Absolutely. But there is ways to decide who's high risk and who's low risk. We're not even doing that. We're not doing status. We're doing completion of treatment. And so at least on a two-year basis, could we look at these cases and see where they belong? I forget the number. Is there 100 people in there who are developmentally disabled? That's the number right at the bottom. 100 people developmentally disabled. You know what we do in my committee? We find housing for them. And we help them to be safe from people who would treat them as, who would predate upon them. Is that a right term? And so now these people did a bad act, a terrible act, or 10 terrible acts, but they're not capable to learn about how to complete treatment. So we're going to leave them in jail in this treatment center for how long they can live at $327 a day, $120,000 a year. Really? That's what we do in our penal system? Oh, wait, it's not the penal system. It's civil commitment. And they're there for treatment with the expectation that they're going to improve. This amendment, imperfect though it is a really good amendment, and it moves a long ways in treating these people with the human and the constitutional rights that they are entitled to, and upon which they will receive no freedom from this oversight to which they're not entitled. So it's going to go to status of how they are. And people like this 26-year-old who spent 15 years in a treatment thing, his life is ruined. And he shouldn't have done that thing with his sister when he was 11. Nobody argues that. Unanimous vote. Bad choice. Terrible. Send him, fix him up. Lock him in the juvie system. And do whatever you want to him. But at this point, I don't think he's going to improve a lot. I don't think he's going to go after his sister. And his sister and him have tried to reconcile. It's a terrible story. That's one of the ones we're going to judge by. And so I encourage you, as you discuss this further, to consider what happens if we don't do something. And it's upon us, as leaders and as elected officials, the state relies upon us to keep them safe, but also to be just to the people that we're keeping incarcerated and treated in our systems. And that's it's a balancing act. But people like Chief Justice Magnuson, who knows way more about this than me, says this is a good idea. He says this is a good idea. And I'll tell you, I'm a chiropractor. But I've learned to listen to experts. And between him and Judge Rosenbaum and the other justices there, Judge Geeran, one of the people who has to decide to let these people out, says, I don't know what to do. I don't have enough information. And so if you're the federal judge, listen to testimony from someone like that, it's like, really? I think we're at risk. I don't know when they're going to let them out. Just let them out. But we're at risk of that. And this committee, on a bipartisan basis, has a responsibility. That's why I'm working with my colleague here. So I've come back tonight. I was going to go home and I'll stop in. This is really important. Is it hard? Absolutely hard. But this needs to get off the floor and go to conference, or just go off the floor and get signed. This bill has been scrutinized by the people who are serving on the committee that Don is looking after and that we've been a privilege to be part of. And as a group, we generally agree. That group doesn't agree in anything, but they agree this makes sense. And so I urge you to ask whatever questions you have to get comfortable with it. And tonight, vote to move this out. I don't care if it's a voice vote or if nobody votes but one person. Let this thing get out of there, out of here, onto the way to doing the justice by which we're so proud of ourselves, of administering in this state, and letting those who can be treated in different sites be treated. Is it economics? Is it humanity? I don't care about humanity for these individuals, very frankly. They have done some terrible crimes. But we have a duty to them to protect their constitutional rights. And that's upon the basis. That's the basis we'll be judged upon. So I didn't mean to go off, but I found this to be most interesting. There's a great diversion from my usual work here. I don't want to be a lawyer. I'm not going to read the minutes. Representative Paymer, I helped create the minutes. So, and the fiscal note, I see Representative Johnson is gone. The fiscal note around here is the Bible. We are constitutionally charged to balance a budget based upon fiscal notes. And more fiscal notes, and when they equal the money we have, actually the props don't work because they're not really fiscal notes, but you would take all the fiscal notes in my budget and lay up a stack. And when I hit my target of fiscal notes, I've done my job by the Constitution. Trust the fiscal note. These guys are not about to tell you that they can't do something for what they said it costs. And if they doesn't make it, they'll have to live within their means and make it work. Most of the cost here is for the additional review, biennial review. If it costs money, it means they're not doing it. Embarrassing, not legal, unconstitutional. So I didn't mean to preach to you, but I didn't come by this enthusiasm and passion about this until I sat with Representative Cornish for way too many meetings working on a bill we never even introduced, and the time with these tremendous experts who are the thought leaders and the true experts in this matter. So I'll stop there, but I urge you to let this bill go and let it move to the Rules Committee.
Other questions? Representative Cornish.
Now I'll give you the other side, Madam Chair. I'll try to make this short, but the people involved here are really, really, really bad, scary people. And I don't mean to sensationalize it, but even the poster child set for a release was a very, very scary people. And Dennis Benson, the ex-director, said that these people could never be cured. The director of the sex offender program admitted they could never be cured and admitted that they would likely to be reoffend. So what we're doing basically is throwing out a gamble, like you said, with some scary people. But something has to be done. So my solution, I should have said this morning that Chief Justice Magnuson offered for me to be on the committee. And I didn't want to partake because I knew they would come up with these resolutions. I knew that the resolutions wouldn't be for prison like I had recommended, and I thought it would be for release like the judge had wanted us to do. And so I didn't want my fingerprint on it at all, because my idea was in my bill that I presented, and I had the county attorneys saying they're interested and they would work on it. The public defender said they were interested and they would work on it. Nobody shot it down. I got kudos for presenting it, but we still dropped it. And basically, it was the end of the sex offender program as we know it. Keep it going. We have to. But stop sending people there. Give them a 60-year sentence. Put them where they belong at the reduced cost. Put them in prison for 60 years. My idea was to create a special class called a predatory sexual offender. These would be the heinous crimes, and that's where they would go. They would go to the 60 years. They would be put away. And by the time they got out, they probably wouldn't be able to do much because they'd be at least 78 or 80-some years old. And the other ones we'd sentence regularly. And by the sex offender program's own admission, there's a lot of people that we're releasing right now that don't go to sex offender, that go back to the community. They're even more dangerous than the sex offender people. And Danae says that supposedly the sex offender recidivism rate is very low. So what have we got to fear from making the heinous crimes, like the sex offender program crimes, into a special category, send them away for 60 years, and then they get out at 78 or 80 or some years old and sentence the other ones regular? That stops the flow there to the sex offender program. And the incarceration, you don't run into the constitutional problem because you don't have to treat them when they're incarcerated. And even though they have a program there, they treat them before they get out and they say their program is good. But it's a heck of a reduced cost in the SOP program. So I think we should stop what we're doing and in the interim get back together and look at House File 6 or whatever it was and start sending these people to prison, stop the flow to the sex offender program, keep it going, SOP, for what we have to do with the special case and for the people we got there. And they're really, it's a threat for the constitutional challenge that's been there forever. Everybody says, judge is going to let them go, judge is going to let them go. We had this one guy set to, and I think if the commissioner wanted to right now, she can let him go. We've got a process for discharge, provisional discharge, but I don't think she really wants to let him go either. And if she does, then it's, or the commissioner, I shouldn't say she, the commissioner does, then it's all on the commissioner's head. And so what people are trying to do is spread as much blame around as many people as they can so nobody touches a football. Well, the way to make it safer for everybody then is send them to prison with a cheaper cost, no constitutional challenge, and that's where they belong for these really bad crimes. So I would encourage my Republican members here to take the safe route for the community and vote no if we vote on the roll call it, and don't put your fingerprint on this mess and come back in the interim and figure out a better way to do it, like incarceration. So.
Representative Liebling.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Cornish. You know, you could have put in a bill this year, and there, I don't think you did. I mean, it's, you know, we're here now with the bill, and to say, well, we coulda, shoulda, woulda, we don't have those bills before us. And again, we have a federal judge who is telling us that we got to do something, or it sure looks that way. I mean, Chief Justice Magnuson sure feels, and Judge Rosenbaum, who's the other task force co-chair, who's a former federal judge, is equally adamant that we are in jeopardy of having the federal judge do something for us. What you lay out, again, this bill doesn't deal with the criminal side. Somebody can still do that, and perhaps we should. I'm not, but this bill is not about that. There are people who are done with their sentences, and even if today we said anybody who ever commits a sex offense goes to prison for life, we still have a very serious problem because there are many, many people who are not incarcerated, who finish their terms, and or who are finishing a term who, that started long ago under an old sentence, and we have to deal with these people. And yeah, you wouldn't be committed. Nobody would be committed to MSOP if they weren't a very serious offender. There's no question about that. But part of this for me as a policymaker is that we are spending so much of our resources, more and more and more, on a very, very, very small piece of the problem. And we do almost nothing on the broader problem. And, for example, this horrible case that we just all read about from Cleveland, that guy has no prior offenses. This program would have done nothing for him. He would never have been petitioned. So there are, you know, let's not kid ourselves. our communities could be a lot safer. There's a lot we're not doing, and we should be approaching that problem. But again, just to move this bill through, I'm not able to do that on this bill, but we do need to address that. So all of those issues are still out there, Representative Cornish. This bill only tries to bite off a small piece, and that is to keep these people that we know are dangerous. Some of them are going to remain there forever. They're going to die in that program because they're not going to be treatable, they're not going to participate, whatever. But those who can, we have to show the court that we're giving them the opportunity. And the science of this is pretty good. It isn't perfect, but from what we've learned in the task force, this is not just, you know, throw the papers down the stairs and see which one lands on the bottom. There is a science to this, and the experts, if it's done carefully, have the ability to, you know, do a very careful step down, see how people do, control it, and a pretty decent prediction process. And is it perfect? No, of course not. You know, nothing we do in social sciences or medical science or any of that is ever a perfect predictor, but it's pretty darn good. And again, it's not this versus the perfect. It's this versus do nothing. And we just can't afford that.
Representative Cornish.
The reason I didn't introduce a bill this year, I'm not in the habit of jumping on a bicycle with no wheels. I don't introduce bills that I know are never going to pass, and that wouldn't have a snowball's chance in Hades, the bill, Pulse 506. The other thing, to give you an idea how scary this is, give you Mankato for an example. We released a couple offenders there. They were there. First of all, a big stink was put up. Nobody wanted any part of it. And sure enough, after they got there, they end up reoffending and going back. And this bill, the people in it are so scared that the sex offender program, that in this original bill, the testimony we heard from the sex offender program folks is they aren't having any luck getting anybody interested in taking one of these less restrictive places. St. Peter is about the only place that'll take them on Moose Lake because there's already established. But they're not having any luck in any other community. And so they knew they were going to have to force them. So in the original bill was language saying that it was going to preempt the cities from passing any ordinance against these places. And basically, we're going to have to shove it down their throat. That's why I don't think this is going to work. You aren't going to talk anybody into this, and you're going to have this conglomeration of people in Representative Mulder's district again where you're going to build the thing because there's so many of them there already. So I still think the best idea is reconsider this, and send them to prison for the cheaper cost, and stop the flow into the SOP program.
Madam Chair.
Representative Liebling.
Well, thank you. And Representative Cornish, but my point is that you could do both. Doing, you know, stopping the flow, as you call it, you can't stop it soon enough to solve the problem that we have today. And if the court decides that our program is so bad that it's just plain not going to exist anymore, then we have a real problem. And there are, as Representative Paymar pointed out, there are only 20 states that even have a civil commitment program. I don't know what the other 30 do, but they're not civilly committing sex offenders, and nobody's ever told me that, you know, how they manage that, but, you know, maybe somebody else here knows. But I'm just saying that your solution is not an alternative to the bill that's before us. It's on those, like we said, there's a, you know, a beginning, a middle, and an end. And yours maybe deals with the beginning. But this bill doesn't change the beginning or the end. It doesn't change the standard. It deals with the people that are there now and that are coming in the pipeline right now. And we don't have another alternative. These are not people that we can put in jail, in prison. We just can't. They're not. They haven't committed a new crime. And if they do, great. Get them out of this system and into the criminal system.
Representative Abler.
Well, thank you, and I agree with Tony that we do need to have a way to get him on the front end. But there's two parts there: the pipeline and the people that are in the program now. And there's nothing to do. You can't change the law after a person offends that are in these places to make those 60 or 80 year sentences come to pass. They've already been charged and paid their and done their sentences based upon whatever the jury and judge decided at the time. What this does do is the people on the way in, when they're decided they're going to be committed to the program, there's two decisions to make. That's the bifurcated part, where you decide, yes, they're going to be committed, And the second thing is, where are we going to put them? In Moose Lake or someplace else? Part of the reason why this kid got stuck in Moose Lake was the prosecutor had no other choice but to send him there or let him go. And I don't know why they didn't let him go. It seems like he's been through enough treatment just from the testimony I got. But that's what happens. And so just wanted to bring that up, that this does do something on the front end about putting him in a less restricted place. Oh, the last thing I wanted to mention, I was forgetting. There is no preemption. And just because a bill elsewhere had preemption doesn't mean this bill does. There are three places under contract today that they could put people in if they had people to put there. And so the first three are handled. This has no preemption whatsoever. Senator Lurie made it pretty clear that we weren't about to do any preemption there, boys and girls. Because I'd be happy to put him to preempt and put him in Representative Paymar's neighborhood, and he'd be happy to stick him in mine, but we're not going to vote to put him anywhere near each of our own. And that's the problem. But that's why it's up to the department to figure out a way to do this within existing law. Within existing law. Within existing standards. And whatever those are, nothing changes about that. So I wanted to point that out to you as well.
Other questions? Remember, Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Blash. I didn't.
Oh,
Madam Chair,
that's let him go.
Representative Boleen's fault. She had me on the list for the past 20 minutes.
And she did tell me. She actually leaned over and told me, and I forgot in 2 seconds.
You're just taking the fall for her.
No. And so members,
let him go.
So we're going to hear from Representative Blash. Then we're going to hear from Representative Scott, and as soon as we have a quorum in the room, we're going to vote.
Okay, thank you. Madam Chair, Representative Liebling, how many people are we talking about if we don't pass something that it's saying they got to find a place for? How many people vote?
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, we have close to 700, I think, in the program right now, and the growth expected is about 50 a year. So we're talking a lot of people and growing very, very fast. And when you see the graph, I wish I had one with me that shows the growth of the program, it just goes pretty impressive.
Representative Lesh.
We've got the current fiscal was shown somewhere, depending on the metrics, $406 a day or something. What's the current per diem we're talking about?
Madam Chair and Representative Lesh. Oh, he's got it here. $326, I'm told, is the current per diem.
And
Representative Lesh.
Okay. Madam Chair, I guess my next question would be for Representative Cornish. I understand your idea, and I think I have some concerns, as you well know, Representative Cornish, about sentencing parity, and I think one of the other things Dennis Benson said back in the day when we sprang Alfonso Rodriguez and we had Drew Shaheen and Donald Baum and Cater Poirier, after which the legislature reacted, was that aside from the fact that these folks were potentially incurable, was also that they were some of the individuals for whom were motivated by sentencing parity, and that if I'm going to get more time for this, what's the disincentive for me not to just murder my victim? So I wonder about that, and I do have concerns about that with your idea for just bumping the sentences, and we haven't talked about that in school for a while, but I wonder about it. That said, in light of Representative Liebling's comments that even if we did that, it would address future crimes, for this, however many hundred, 700, I think you said, people, what's your plan for them without having a new crime? What would we do with them?
For me?
Representative Cornish?
Well, I'll answer that question with another scary scenario, first of all. I'll answer your question directly, but what we're being asked here to do is vote to send these people, we don't even know where or how, just less restrictive means. And to give you an idea how bad that is, St. Peter and Moose Lake is where we got the sex offenders now, right? St. Peter is a horrible train wreck right now. They hired the director of the program without doing a background check, and found out, they fired him after they found out that they failed a background check. They've got psychiatrists leaving the program that treat the patients, like seven of them. And they can't find anybody to work there right now. And now a judge just ruled against the psychiatrist that they weren't even given a patient care and let him sit there for days and days without any medication. He went bonkers and got injured. It's a train wreck. And that's where we're putting our sex offenders. And they want us to trust us to vote for this bill, less restrictive means. We don't even know where they're going, what town or what kind of building or a barn or what. So it's really hard for me to imagine having any faith in this bill. For what we're doing with them right now, let them sit. I mean, this is a fallacy that the Judge Guerin is going to turn a bunch of sex offenders loose in Wilmer, Minnesota on their own. I mean, come on. So my thing is to retool in the interim and find out a better method, because what we got here is scary.
Well, Madam Chair.
So, okay, so everybody wants to respond to that. So, I know it was your question, Representative Lesh. We do have a quorum back in the room, so we're going to let Representative Lesh go, then we're going to let Representative Liebling go, then we're going to let Representative Scott go, and then I'm going to make a statement, and then we're going to vote. So, Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, Representative Cornish, I understand that. I understand these are scary people. But you can imagine why we have the lawsuit, because the alternative is potentially scary to the rule of law also. In other countries, they've had a Bastille, they've had a gulag, they've had other kinds of institutions where you lock people up for a reason when you just want them to go there. In other countries, in political prisoners. Here, we happen to feel like we have a pretty decent reason to do it, but when they've been convicted of a crime, you've got to have a really good reason. Hence, it's not standard and it's expensive. So I'm thinking about what you're talking about, how scary they are. But I'm also thinking about the rule of law that we have in this country and the implications if we aren't really careful about it. So I just want to make that comment, Madam Chair.
Representative Liebling.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to clear up some misconceptions, because what Representative Cornish is talking about is a security hospital, which is not where sex offenders go. That's completely separate. It is under DHS that where those problems have been. This is the sex offender program. And people get confused because in St. Peter, there's a campus where both they have both, but they're very separate. And so I just wanted to clear that up. And, you know, again, the problem is that there are a range of people in this program. The 700 people are not all the same. And some of them are very, very scary, and they belong there, and they're probably never going to get out because of, you know. But there are a range of people, and I just want to make sure that everybody understands. This would be a process where courts and prosecutors would decide where people are placed, just like they do now in sentencing. You have a hearing, and everybody comes in, and they argue, and they say 20 years. Now, this is not, I'm making an analogy to the criminal system, which this is not. But it's a similar process where you have a hearing, where the county attorney says, this guy's dangerous, he needs to go to Moose Lake, and there are, you know, examiners, and there's a hearing, and the judge makes the decision. And then for somebody to, you know, every 2 years under our bill, a judge would be looking at the stuff and saying, is there even any reason to even think about having a hearing in this case? And if the judge thinks there's enough evidence of a change to even have a hearing, then there's a full-fledged hearing where county attorneys come in and there's evidence and people discuss whether a change should be made, and if so, what that change should be. So this isn't just us taking this bill and saying, let's take 700 people and just throw them into less restrictive alternatives. Far from it. This is a very careful, if you think judges can't make those decisions and prosecutors can't help make those decisions, then you don't have much faith in the criminal justice system either, because these are the same people bringing their expertise to bear with very experienced examiners who understand sex offenders, all of that brought to bear on every one of these decisions. And that's what the courts demand of us, because these are individual people. They're not 700 of the same person. They come in with different circumstances. And that's why, under the Constitution, we have to treat them as people with different circumstances.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just, you know, my primary concerns are that we are starting to build on something, and we don't know what the next few steps are going to be. And that makes me nervous. And it also makes me nervous that, to my knowledge, there's never been an evaluation done of the current treatment that is being done at Moose Lake. So we don't know if it's effective. And I just have so many hesitancies about this bill. I just, you know, we talk about it's not ready for prime time, but I just don't think this is ready for prime time yet. And I just think it needs more vetting. And so that's all I wanted to say.
Representative Liebling?
Thanks, Madam Chair. And, well, I don't know if any minds are going to be changed beyond this point, but I think that the statement that, you know, the treatment hasn't been evaluated and stuff, I don't think that's accurate. But, you know, I think it's late, and I know people want to get moving here, and so I think that, you know.
Representative Abler, did you have anything else to add before we vote?
I think they're fully informed of what I am.
All right. So, members, I just wanted to make a couple of statements before we vote. Representative Liebling, I know you've done a lot of work with the task force on this issue, and I know that we don't always necessarily agree on how these issues should be dealt with. But, members, I'm going to be voting yes on this bill today. I'm actually going to be moving it. And what I want you to know is one of the reasons why I'm doing that is because it is court in and court out. And all of the evaluations about what the level of care and security and treatment is going to be determined through the courts. And I have a high amount of regard for the court and their ability to assess. Now, I believe that there have been some challenges with this program, and I believe that there are other places in the DHS that you are going to be working on as well. And I know that in your bill there are some treatment things that are going to be changed, and I know that we will be working hard to hold these folks accountable. Do I think this bill is perfect in its current form? No, but I believe that it will be working its way through the committee process. I know it has other places to go, and the next stop is rules. And I commit to you that I will continue to make certain that anyone in the public who wants to be heard on it has the opportunity, and that every question that needs to be asked gets asked, because these are difficult decisions to make. And so I'm going to vote for your bill today. And I look forward to continuing to work to make it better. As I see each and every time we've seen this proposal, you have worked hard to improve it. So with that, I would move that House File 1139 be recommended to pass as amended and be sent to the Rules Committee. A roll call has been requested from Representative Drazkowski prior to the committee taking a break. Was that your request, Representative Drazkowski, or did you want to make a statement?
I had a quick process question.
Representative Drazkowski.
I'm just curious, Madam Chair, will this bill be going to HHS Finance or public safety or civil law or any of those committees?
Representative Drazkowski, in order for it to go anywhere else, it has to go to rules first.
Okay.
So all of those decisions will be made about what the process is. It'll go from here to rules, and then they will disseminate the bill to whichever other committees it needs to properly go to.
Thank you.
All right. Other questions from members? All right. The clerk will take the roll.
Representative Hillstrom.
Aye.
Representative Moline.
Yes.
Representative Drazkowski.
No.
Representative Cornish.
No.
Representative Johnson S.
Yes.
Representative Lesh.
Aye. Aye, aye.
Representative Paymar.
Aye.
Representative Scott.
With 5 in favor and 3 opposed, the motion passes. The bill is sent to the Rules Committee. Thank you, Representative Liebling. This meeting is adjourned.